So I think, it fits quite nicely with this continuing theme of black holes and also about quantum properties of black holes vis-à-vis thermodynamics, in the sense of what I want to talk about is a non-isolated black hole. And of course, I'll also be going down to three dimensions, which is what this little picture actually illustrates. So just to give a brief outline, I'm just going to start by saying what I mean by acceleration very briefly, because I think sometimes perhaps we assume that we all know what we mean. But in a recent version of a variation of this talk, I realized that maybe it's not quite so clear. I'll then talk about accelerating black holes in 4D, and this is all really around this idea of geometry, or how acceleration is caused by geometrical features. And in particular, this brings back to cosmic strings, which I'll talk about. And then I want to talk about the thermodynamics of tension, or the thermodynamics of these accelerating black holes. And then I'll briefly sort of mention about something to do with the isoperimetric inequality. But then I'll finish off, and this is probably the most geometrical part of it, in the sense of it's like a photo album in a way, talking about acceleration in three dimensions. In other words, focusing on the geometry of acceleration. So the first half, if you like, is more around four-dimensional black holes, sort of traditional black holes, but different in the sense that they're being pulled, whereas the latter part is about what happens in three dimensions, which may or may not actually give us some useful sort of toys, if you like, to play with, because, of course, gravity in three dimensions is kind of much better understood from a quantum perspective. So just to be clear, what do we mean by acceleration? Well, essentially, what I would mean by acceleration is when you're not in an inertial frame. So that's going back, if you like, to Einstein's point of view. And effectively, that just means that you're not going along a geodesic. So grad t of t is not proportional to t. So a pertinent example for what I'm going to be talking about is to look at an observer in ADS that maintains a fixed distance from the center of ADS. And so this is ADS space in the wrong signature for me, of course, but nonetheless. This is our global coordinate system for ADS. And if you're at a fixed r, it turns out you're an accelerating observer, even though you're static in the background space-time. So your tangent vector here is just a fixed multiple of d by dt, because you're not actually moving throughout the space. And then when you compute the acceleration, that is actually radial. So that's what I mean by an accelerating frame. And this really is a Rindler space-time. But whereas you're used to accelerating observers having horizons, that's not the case for ADS, because effectively you're just at some, you're not actually moving, I guess, would be a way of putting it. So the magnitude of the acceleration is related to this displacement from the origin r naught. So you can write that a squared is goes like r naught squared, at least for small r naught. And or you could write that r naught is sort of telling you something about a, all in units of the ADS radius. Yes?
How do you account for a free fall of a particle and the equivalence principle?
So in this case, this particle isn't free falling. I mean, what we'll see once, this is just a probe particle, but what we'll see when we give it some masses, we have to exert a force to keep it there. So this is not a freely falling, which is what you see by having A. Yep. It's a bit like us on the surface of the Earth. We're kind of static with respect to the Earth, but we're not in an inertial frame, and thence we feel a force, which we call gravity. So if we want, that was a probe particle, as I was just saying, but if we want to actually have some back reaction, then this is where this metric that's been known for pretty much over a century now, the C metric, comes in. So you can have a little snooze if you're well aware of the C metric. But just to sort of highlight, this is an example of a simple C metric, no rotation or charge. And what you see is, again, I'm doing this in ADS. The ADS part is, you see, coming in from this length scale. Here we have the sort of standard black, familiar black hole potential, but then this A, which is the acceleration, comes in three different points in the metric. First of all, it shifts the potential, Newtonian potential, I guess we used to usually call it, and you see that it comes in with a sort of R squared power. So in a sense, that is where you see it competing with the ADS part, and this would be why you would get a Rindler horizon if there was no background cosmological constant, or an acceleration horizon, I should say. But it also comes in by distorting the angular part of the metric. So we see now that this we've got this G of theta, which comes in differently in front of the azimuthal angle and the zenith angle. Finally, it comes in a conformal factor in front of the whole metric. Now, of course, this is just one choice of coordinates. In this particular case, it's not the canonical GR ones, but it's some coordinates that Hong and Teo put forward. Yes?
Sorry, maybe I missed the point. Are you saying that this is a solution of Einstein's equation?
Yeah. Yes. It's a solution of the Einstein equations with a negative cosmological constant, where the cosmological constant's minus 3 on L squared in 4D. So in essence, what you're seeing is you're shifting where infinity is. That's what the omega does. You're kind of shifting potentially a horizon structure or not. And you're also distorting the two spheres around the black hole. So that's what A does.
What is capital K?
Ah, thank you. Sorry. So here, what we do is we put the capital K in because we wanted to have our angular coordinate to always have periodicity 2 pi. So phi does not depend on any of the parameters. Sometimes, I think in the original, probably the canonical GR way of writing the C metric, you just have a d phi squared, but then you say a sort of the periodicity can change, you know, you choose it according to maybe making an axis regular. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to have the same set of coordinates while shifting some of the parameters. So therefore we introduce K. And so the space-time that I was just talking about for that observer, a fixed distance from the origin, can be written in this form. And we go between the C form and the global ADS form by this coordinate transformation here. And the only real difference is that if I start with the C form on the previous page, where this is the distance from my observer at little r equals zero, then the time in global time is now alpha t rather than t. So there's a sort of rescaling. So in other words, the observer hovering a fixed distance from the center has a slightly different clock rate than the one at infinity. And it's more just directly related to this AL. So as a picture, this is the space-time part. This is the blue and black are the C coordinates. You see that it is off-center. These are the constant theta lines. And now where omega goes to zero is the boundary, and that happens at finite r in the lower half of the Poincaré disk. But this dashed line here is r equals infinity. So in other words, you kind of have your coordinates do not cover the full patch of ADS. So but it's easily extended by that coordinate transformation. So this is called slowly accelerating Rindler space-time.
Is that Rindler space-time in different coordinates, or is it a different metric?
No, this is just ADS space-time in different coordinates. Yeah, just like Rindler space-time is Minkowski space-time in different coordinates. Yeah, it's exactly analogous to the standard Rindler, except for standard Rindler, you just have a quarter of the Minkowski plane, if you like, because you have your acceleration horizon. Here, there isn't an acceleration horizon, but you do have a sort of limit to your coordinate patch, but you easily, if you just changed coordinates to 1 over r, you'd be this would just be, if y was 1 over r, this would just be y becoming less than 0. So.
But there is no acceleration horizon here.
No, there's no actual horizon. It's just, if you like, the coordinate, you know, r equals infinity, you would normally stop at, except it's not the edge of the space. So you go to infinity and beyond in this space-time, basically, right? Yeah. Okay, so what happens when we introduce the black hole mass? Well, this is where the relevance of that K comes in. And I said that the two spheres were distorted. So to see the distortion, you kind of go to each pole and expand around the pole, around theta is 0 and theta is pi. And so here you see these different factors. Now, if you were near the origin of in polar coordinates, I would just block out this constant, this numerical factor, and this would be like d rho squared plus rho squared d phi squared. When you get a prefactor here that's not 1, that's a signature of a conical singularity of some sort. And so if, again, we see that these different factors give rise to what we would call a deficit angle or an excess conical deficit, conical excess or conical deficit. And typically we interpret this as a cosmic string. Now, just to make a point that this is a sort of exact singularity, so we're putting everything at theta is 0 and pi, but we can, in fact, replace these sharp singularities by a smoothed out core using a real sort of model for a cosmic string. So notice these prefactors are different, and so that means we have two different deficit angles running out of each pole, which corresponds to two different energy per unit lengths. So just pictorially, a cosmic string is something that, broadly speaking, is a highly concentrated energy momentum source, which we rather dubiously write as a delta function, which you shouldn't really, but it's physically that's sort of what it's doing, for which you have an energy per unit length and a tension equal in magnitude, and the sort of transverse and energy momenta are roughly 0. This cuts out a cone, and so this is like the space-time of the cosmic string. You have no tidal forces, there's no long-range curvature, it's a global effect, it's a geometrical global effect. And you can thread strings onto black holes, and that was just what I was saying, that this is just, this exact solution in GR is interpreted as an idealization of something where you replace this sharp singularity by some finite width core.
Is this cosmic string somehow keeping this black hole in a place where it can actually have a non-zero acceleration?
Yeah, that's what this picture is. So the slowly accelerating black hole, where it is suspended off center, we interpret that as a black hole. We can regularize one axis, and it's a black hole suspended from the boundary with a cosmic string. So this is like a cartoon of the space-time. So, yeah, normally a general C metric would have acceleration horizons, as we've sort of some of the questions have revealed, but we focused, for the purpose of thermodynamics, on this slow acceleration situation, just because then we've got one single horizon, which is the black hole horizon. So it's sort of, there's no ambiguity. So this is a somewhat different solution in GR, because it's saying that it's not an isolated black hole. So just to say that even though that is true, you can still do thermodynamics. So let me just give an illustration of how you go about, or how you go about it. And this is where, I don't know, I often find black hole thermodynamics quite mysterious, because in essence, what you're often doing is looking in parameter space of black holes. You're sort of saying, well, what if I vary M, or what if I vary the vacuum energy, or charge, or rotation, by throwing something into the black hole, or having some background field determining a vacuum energy. So what you do, if you know you're going through a class of black holes, is you know that the black hole horizon is defined by F is zero. So if you throw something into the black hole, or whatever, you change something about it, you know that F still has to be zero, but then you expand, you know, well, okay, I know what F is, so if I increment by delta R, I just take F prime delta R. If I change the mass, it's just df dm delta M. If I change the vacuum energy, it's just df dl delta L. And so for this example of just a string running through a black hole, this is kind of what I would get. And then I simply say, what is my temperature? Euclidean method gives you this. My entropy, because I've sort of chopped a cone out of space, I've dropped the area of the black hole. So my entropy depends on K. So normally, if you were doing this process, this delta R would directly feed into entropy, and the F prime would be the T. But here, delta S is no longer just delta R plus if K changes. So what you find is that this, taking this generalized variation, you need to think about what K represents. K represents this tension. And so a delta K would be a delta mu. And so, and this bottom line is really just allowing for extended thermodynamics, where you vary the vacuum energy and you have a thermodynamic volume. So the first law with tension, putting all this together, you see you have delta of M on K is TdS VdP, and then you have a delta mu term should the tension be changing. And so you, in this case, you identify the enthalpy, as we now understand, with M on K. And that sort of makes sense, because if you form the black hole by collapse, if you've cut a chunk out of space-time, if you sort of think of a collapsing shell, the shell would have less area, hence less mass. So it kind of makes sense. That's...
Is that the tension of the string?
Yeah.
And your picture has strings on both sides.
Yeah.
But your previous picture has a string on one side.
That's right. So this is not an accelerating black hole. This was meant to illustrate, in a calculationally simpler situation, how the conical deficits contribute. Yeah.
Which one is the right picture now? Is this the right picture or the previous one?
So in this case, for that first law, this is the right picture, because I've only got a single mu. Okay. So what I'm trying to do is just give an illustration of the method in a situation where it's very clean, and, you know, because in the end, when for the full singing, dancing, bells and whistles one, it's a real, you know,
messy.
Yeah, it's messy. That's one way of putting it. So here, with the term multiplying the variation in tension, we called a thermodynamic length because it had the dimensions of length. And it kind of reinforces this idea of the mass, or M, sorry, should I say, as enthalpy. So it's sort of part, you know, it's saying as the black hole grows, the energy budget, you know, it's also swallowing some string. and displacing string from the environment. So having said that was a sort of an example or a sample thermodynamic situation, what we really wanted to do was to look at the accelerating black hole. And actually, although I've got this illustration here, in general, we want to have a string coming out of each pole, potentially with different tensions. So we would have a dmu plus and a dmu minus. But this is the all singing, all dancing symmetric, where we include charge, we include rotation, we've got acceleration, and we're sticking with our ADS situation with no second horizon. So you see that there's a lot going on in this metric. You've got off-diagonal terms, you've got the H was what was previously G, which is now, you know, a lot more complex, a function of theta and the parameters. And then you notice that we've put this alpha in as well to allow for the fact that the time ticking with this black hole might not correspond to a time, well, it won't correspond to a time at infinity. So some things that, you know, we can calculate, we know what the temperature is because we use a Euclidean method and you see alpha creeping in. We know the entropy because we can calculate the area. And the entropy here is sort of dependent on this K, which is sort of telling us about an overall deficit almost, and the acceleration. To find M, we used a sort of standard tools from holography because, again, we're in ADS. And so we use this sort of Pfefferman-Graham expansion where, because our original coordinates of r and theta are not actually, are sort of off-center relative to the boundary, we want to have a coordinate z which tells us when we're on the boundary. Z goes to zero. And then we want to have a sort of cos nu theta. So if you like x, a new x coordinate, which is this psi. And so you basically just follow, crank the handle on the Pfefferman-Graham method. And the f and g are just determined by these requirements that there's no off-diagonal terms in the metric, that we have the leading order term is 1 on z squared, then everything else is finite. And this is just a series expansion near the boundary. And the, you know, that tells us what the boundary metric is up to a conformal factor, and it allows us to find the boundary stress tensor. So this is just a plot of what it looks like. And then we simply integrate up the energy to get the mass. And you see there's an alpha also cropping up here. So if we didn't have M and we asked that the boundary was around 2-sphere, we'd recover the alpha that we found for that Rindler coordinate transformation. So Nyayash, it's not just messy, it's disgusting doing the computation. But eventually, and it took us a while, several false starts, you do get a consistent first law with corrections to the thermodynamic volume, the thermodynamic length, and in particular, obviously, we got rotation. It was rotation that made it so disgusting. So these are our thermodynamic parameters.
So
yes.
So when you go to the boundary, there must be these, I guess, poles that are missing or something. So does something happen at those points, like the poles?
Yeah, so the boundary does have an actual conical deficit on it. So it's really, if you like, it's ADS CFT, but not as we know it, you know. So it's really, so I think, you know, like Veronica and Hubini and Mukund Rangamani did some work with, I think they called it droplets and funnels. So they always put the horizon to the boundary to cloak any singularities. But yeah, we checked our expressions and they're completely consistent. Sorry, I saw a hand somewhere here. Yeah.
Sorry, I had a question. What is the dimension of K? I see it everywhere.
K is dimensionless. Just as the deficit angle is dimensionless. I guess I've suppressed, Yeah, I have suppressed G's here, although probably mentally I always put G's back in. But in fact, you know, when you see mu, that would be G mu, which is dimensionless. Okay, so again, it's just sort of to make things a bit cleaner.
I guess one thing I don't understand is do you have like singular? I guess you have singularities at the boundary, but is it just conical singularities? So everything is fine, and you're just missing a portion.
They're conical singularities. I'm not sure whether that means everything is fine, but
yeah.
Conical singularities, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, I mean, this is not meant, you know, this is just meant to illustrate or perhaps to back up my statement that it really is quite disgusting doing this calculation. We also double check the mass, not just via holographic methods, but a sort of Ashtakar or conformal completion method, we tried it a bunch of different ways. So that sort of is just saying that, in fact, you can do thermodynamics of non-isolated black holes. If you want to change the tension of the strings, you can do that. There are associated thermodynamic potentials with that. How would the tension change? Well, maybe you could imagine a black hole capturing a cosmic string, for example. But essentially, apart from the mess, it's doable. If you want to then, sorry, yeah.
So maybe I missed it, but do you run into any problems with the fact that, I guess, the space-time isn't, at least globally, asymptotically flat?
Not particularly, no. I mean, nothing. I mean, just in the same way that a sort of straight infinite cosmic string is not globally flat, it's locally flat, at least if it was in vacuum. And it's, you know, there's no, you know, it's it, at least not, I'm not aware of there being any real issues with that, but then I like strings.
Are these what are called small black holes or the large black holes in ADS?
So this is independent of whether they're small or large. So in fact, I don't have slides on it here, but we can also look at Hawking Page. The Hawking Page transition happens at the same point, although the free energy is changed if you have deficits. Yeah, so it's remarkably similar. And in fact, the reason I was just going to briefly talk about or show the chemical expressions is precisely so you can study the phase structure, the thermodynamic phase structure of the black holes, except when you do this, it's easier to have an average deficit and a differential deficit to identify what part of the physics is coming from the conical sort of nature and what part is coming from acceleration. And it turns out that, in fact, acceleration has a relatively small impact on the phase properties of the black holes, whereas the average conical deficit has a stronger impact. So just to see, these are the chemical expressions for the thermodynamic parameters. So here, what you'd see is you just see things in terms of S, P, Q, J, the delta, which is the average deficit, and the C, which is the acceleration parameter. So, you know, this to me, anyway, I think this looks nicer. It also means that this is, although all of these quantities are related to properties of the geometry, there's no metric parameters in here at all. These are all sort of thermodynamic quantities. And as I was just saying, it allowed us to sort of, for example, find a Hawking Page transition. And also, I think I'll skip the discussion of this, but let me just take a question before moving on.
So I see we've sort of adopted the interpretation that we have a black hole that's being pulled along by a cosmic string.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also seen a discussion on the C metric where you take this metric and you do a sort of inverse Rindler transformation to take the coordinate observer out of the accelerating frame, And then the interpretation is then instead that there are two black holes that are coming together and being forced back apart by like a spring.
That is if you have an acceleration horizon. So that's absolutely correct if you're in, for example, vacuum. So there's no cosmological constant. So the black holes are sort of approximately following the trajectories of two accelerating Rindler observers. In this case, that's not the situation because we're in the slow acceleration limit. There's no acceleration horizon. There is just the black hole in the ADS bath, which is being suspended from infinity. So we kept a slow acceleration for doing the thermodynamics so as not to have to deal with this notion that the temperatures might be different on the two horizons. So that was the reason for it. But in essence, once you're sort of confident you can do it, you can, you know, then breeze along and do other things. But yeah. So I just in the interests of time, I won't go over it, but this is just the reverse isoperimetric inequality. And isoperimetric in maths is essentially saying that you maximize the area enclosed by a perimeter if you have it circular, or if you have a given length, then you minimize. I'm going to get tied in knots. Anyway, that's the standard mathematical one. The reason why it's worrying for black holes is you always want to maximize entropy. And entropy is, if you like, related to that parametric quality. So you actually, for a given volume, want to maximize the sort of perimeter length, which is not the isoperimetric inequality. It's like a reverse one. And so we managed to prove, using the chemical expressions, a reverse isoperimetric inequality. In other words, it's this way around, not the other one, for black holes with an average deficit. So I just wanted to finish off in the last 10 minutes, I guess, just saying sort of essentially with a slideshow of asking what is acceleration in three dimensions. Now, there's been a range of sort of work on C type of metrics in three dimensions, but either because of the focus of the papers or for whatever reason, they didn't really look at what the structure of the space-time was, and in some cases didn't spot that the cos of theta was imaginary. So we kind of started looking at how do you get acceleration in three dimensions, what does it look like, and found that you can get three different types of solution. So there's sort of essentially you use gauge symmetry to kind of, you know, reduce everything down to its, this is sort of, I guess, typically what relativists do, to its bare bones. And there are three classes. One is where x is like a cos theta. So this would be sine squared theta. So q is sort of coming, well, I guess there isn't a d phi, is there? But this would be sort of analogous to sort of reducing the 4D situation. Then there's a second class where you have the x coordinate now being like a cosh rather than a cos. And then finally, the last class is where x is something different altogether. So in the first case, x has to be less than 1. In the second case, mod x is bigger than 1. And in the final case, x can be whatever you like. So you see that you still got this sort of 1 over this p is like sort of like the f of r. The y coordinate is a bit like 1 on r. And so these are sort of like three-dimensional Newtonian potentials. And so I just want to say what these each correspond to in turn. So in three dimensions, there's no propagating degrees of freedom for gravity. So if you have mass, that just induces curvature locally. And so a point particle in three dimensions is just, guess what? A conical deficit. So it gets sometimes confusing now about strings or walls or whatever. But if you replace x by this cosine and you take R, make R being essentially 1 on Y and rescale time, you find a metric that looks remarkably similar to what we were just dealing with. And so the point particle here is showing up in this K. Just like I said, K was a string before in 4D, if I collapse down along the length of the string becomes a bit like a point particle in 3D, the conical defect. So slow acceleration is AL is less than 1, rapid is AL is bigger than 1, where you have an acceleration horizon. So you kind of see that coming in here from this prefactor. So that's your accelerating particle. And again, you can now ask, how do you get an accelerator? You know, a point particle would just be take the Poincaré disk, cut a little wedge out of it and re-identify. That would be a point particle at the center of ADS3. So what happens if you move that off center, a bit like that slow acceleration Rindler? Well, if you're at the center, the extrinsic curvature of the sort of ends of your piece of cake is zero. So when you re-glue them, there's nothing there. As you move away from center, your cake now starts to distort. And so the edges, if you like, of the slice of cake now have extrinsic curvature. So when you re-identify, you get a localized energy momentum, and that's now a domain wall. So it's your in three dimensions, it is a wall, that a co-dimension one object that causes your point particle to accelerate. So that's why I said it gets confusing over the conical deficits, wall strings, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, you can use Israel's equations to compute what the energy per unit area is of that thing holding the point particle in equilibrium, and you get a picture that's really similar to the four-dimensional one. You're off-center on the Poincaré disk, but now this is the whole two dimensions of your two spatial dimensions. You cut out your wedge, so this is what I was sort of see it bending. This is what I was saying about the piece of cake having, it's not being straight, it's sort of slightly curved. That's a sort of local x equals constant line. You glue together and you get something with tension. So again, the R naught is again look quite similar. In fact, it's the same value. The other way you can follow that same prescription, the Pfefferman-Graham, for calculating the mass of this particular metric, but it's now something that looks, you know, really kind of quite different as a function of the parameters in the metric. So I think in the interest of time, I'm just going to show the plot. This is kind of comparing the particle mass, which is, if you like, the local conical deficit, versus this holographic mass. And you see they more or less track each other with no acceleration. But as you switch on acceleration, you start sort of seeing a really very, if you're strongly accelerating, which means you're near the boundary, your mass barely changes, and then it suddenly kind of whips up as you gradually sort of increase the conical angle. So 5 minutes, I'm guessing. I just also wanted to point out that that whereas some of them have been derived in some form in the literature, we also had found a new solution, which was in a sort of corner of class one, which is a bit like BTZ, but is disconnected from BTZ. In other words, you can't send A to zero. So let me finish off with the baby pictures, if you like, our space times. So here is the slowly accelerating point particle. I don't know how easy it is to distinguish, but you can sort of see here is the wedge that you cut out that gives the conical point particle, the conical defect. This is the trajectory of, it's a rapidly accelerating one here, I guess. And so you cut out the wedge, re-identify, And this is sort of what's left is kind of the rest of the space-time. The main difference to 4D, so this is what you were saying about the two black holes, is you're not obligated to have a partner on accelerating on the other side. Because there's no long-range Riemann curvature, which is kind of what brings you round to the second black hole in 4D. If you have a very, if you increase the conical deficit, keep increasing it, eventually these cutting at constant x loops round and doesn't reach the boundary. So for a very rapidly accelerating heavy particle, you get a sort of rather curious space-time where you sort of lost the boundary altogether. If you're accelerating with a strut, I'll forget about that. This is BTZ, or at least this is the BTZ coordinate system for ADS in BTZ coordinates. BTZ just says cut along these constant phi or x lines and re-identify. These have zero extrinsic curvature, so this is just something that looks like a black hole. And in a sense, we see this with the class two solutions, which is where we now have a different coordinatization. I don't know if you can tell, but it's just a little bit more skew width compared to the BTZ. It's distorted. There's now an extrinsic curvature, so there's now a wall. So that is, if you like, whether it's really an accelerating BTZ, I'm not sure, but at least you could think of it as such. So rapid acceleration. This is the novel BTZ that I was mentioning, which is a disconnected region of the class one parameter space, and kind of that's what it looks like. And Nyayesh is standing up. So that's the, finally, just in case you're interested, class three is like a brain world. So let me just recap. I've talked about allowing for varying tension in thermodynamics of black holes and how geometrically this corresponds to black holes being pulled by approximate conical deficits. You get a thermodynamic length, so you have true thermodynamics of these composite systems. And three dimensions sort of has some familiar features and some new features. And I'm just going to finish off with that picture. This is the maximally extended rapidly accelerating heavy particle. So you see that the boundary is kind of chopped off for all of this region here. So thanks.
Thanks a lot. So I have a question online. So the question, I'm just going to narrate it. How would the frame dragging of a spinning black hole affect the tension in a spinning case? If it is even relevant, so that's the question.
So it's kind of interesting because you can put, you know, you can put the strings through black holes. It's from the exact solution that I was presenting here, it's an exact cutting of a conical deficit. For a physical cosmic string, it's a little bit more subtle. There's a little bit of, there is in fact a sort of frame dragging effect that goes on. You know, where the sort of finite width kind of picks that up. But it's still asymptotically the same sort of thing, yeah.
Cool, thanks. Rob?
Well, I have two questions based on that. So one, in the case that we did with the rotating black hole, the direction of rotation, the axis is along the string, but in 2+1, the string is like a wall.
Yeah.
So if the black hole rotates, will the wall rotate with it, or will the wall stay put and the black hole rotate?
That's a good question. We haven't actually thought about the 2+1 rotating. Yeah, you're right. That could be really interesting.
The other thing that I wonder about, one of the nice features about BTZ is that because the space-time is constant curvature, then wave equations are just wave equations in ADS with identification.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do all, is that feature going to persist when you have acceleration?
So, I mean, I don't know, it's probably not as clear here. You've still got everything away from the red line here, which is the accelerating point particle, is just ADS, right? So in this case, you're identifying that with that, right? But inside, it's still just ADS. So it is the same old wave equation. The complication that I could see would be coming from boundary conditions, because with BTZ, you know, it's like a zero extrinsic curvature surface. So I think matching solutions across is quite straightforward. So the only thing that I could see potentially happening would be in matching across the
across the wall,
because you know, so that's the only, sometimes when you match across walls, you get a sort of mixing of modes.
You would have to match at the wall.
Yeah, so I just don't know. I think for a non-static thing like this, it might end up being, sort of being problem, perhaps causing particle creation, right? Because I guess that you would interpret that as coming from some sort of acceleration horizon.
So maybe last question, Sally.
Yeah. Hi. BTZ, you can interpret it exactly as a EDS when you do an amplification by a certain vector, killing vector. So I was wondering, this new solution that you have, can you interpret by the symmetry group in the same way? Because I thought there was like classification of all the quotient you can do. So I was wondering which symmetry you get for this kind of thing.
So that's a good question. This is BTZ, right? This thing here. This is ours. So the honest answer is I'm not sure, because we're not something looked at, but because these lines, if you like, constant coordinate lines, now are sort of, you know, have this non-zero extrinsic curvature, it's a sort of slightly twisted slicing of ADS. I could imagine that the symmetry group might drop a bit. You might break some of the symmetries, but I don't know for sure. Yeah.
Okay.